Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. An odd turn of events, if you ask me. Facebook, which now goes by the name Meta. I don't think Meta is going to catch on. I really don't. I don't think it's going to. I think too many people know it is Facebook. Anyway.
You do not know what you are talking about.
I do. But I do. And I came armed with a Reuters article. Dr. Fauci. Where has Dr. Fauci been for the last, I don't know, 2 months? Have you even heard his voice other than this program? Have you seen him or heard him anywhere?
Where did he go? He's hiding.
He is vanished. He was everywhere. He was like wallpaper for our world. For the last 2 years, you couldn't take a step five. You couldn't walk 5 feet without bumping into Dr. Fauci. And now the guy is nowhere to be seen.
Well, I'm not looking for him. Are you looking for him?
Well, I mean, I've noticed that he's not ubiquitous anymore. The kids would take Dr. Fauci lunchboxes to school. Or so it seemed, but I mean, he's just not anywhere to be seen.
You posted a picture on Twitter of Indiana Jones, the famous scene where he's switching out the idol for a bag of sand, and he's switching out the coronavirus with the Ukrainian flag.
Yeah, the Ukrainian flag, and we all know what happens when that happens.
It's not good.
Yeah, he almost didn't make it. So anyway, I just take note, Dr. Fauci. I don't know how I got onto that topic, but Meta, a.k.a. Facebook, is now, they've announced that Facebook and Instagram will permit calls for violence or even urgings for violence against Russians on Facebook. I thought they were all about let's not do the violence thing. Here's how Reuters is reporting it. Facebook and Instagram users in some countries to call for violence. This will be allowed by Meta platforms. So calling for violence against Russians and Russian soldiers in the context of the Ukrainian invasion, according to internal emails seen by Reuters on Thursday. It's a temporary change in its hate speech policy. Social media, this social media company has also temporarily allowed some posts that call for death to Russian President Vladimir Putin or Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. I knew that guy was bad news for decades, just watching that guy. Now he's sort of come into his full capacity. Anyway, a Meta spokesman, keep in mind, Meta, it just means Facebook. As a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we have temporarily made allowances for forms of political expression that would normally violate our rules, like violent speech such as death to the Russian invaders. We still won't allow credible calls for violence against Russian civilians. The calls for the leaders' deaths will be allowed unless they contain other targets or have two indicators of credibility, such as the location or method, one email said, in a recent change to the company's rules on violence and incitement. Citing the Reuters story, Russia's embassy in the United States demanded that Washington stop the extremist activities, saying users of Facebook and Instagram did not give the owners of these platforms the right to determine the criteria of truth and pit nations against each other. And it goes on in that vein. It's just an interesting and, to my mind at least, an unfortunate development in this whole already terribly unfortunate situation, which is putting it lightly, that now, okay, you can't say, and you'll get shut down, you can't say on Twitter or Facebook that a man can't be a woman and a woman can't be a man. But now you can call for the death of people, including political figures, because given what's going on in Russia and Ukraine, that's now okay. Now, back in World War II, as an example, the United States had a massive, very well-funded, government-backed propaganda effort to shape the opinions of Americans, and rightly so, at least insofar as it was directed against Hitler and Nazism, two evil, in one case an evil man, and in the other case an evil political system. And I have no objection to Americans understanding what Nazism was and is, and Hitler, of course, and rallying against him. But it's very selective that they would open, you know, lower the containment shield for people who want to espouse death to Russian soldiers. Okay, it's wartime. And death to political leaders like Putin. But yet you can't say that a man can't be a woman and a woman can't be a man. Does that seem selective to you, Cyrus? Because it seems selective to me. It seems erratic to me.
Yeah, I think for years we've talked about the kind of censorship that we see in Russia and China, and it might be a little naive to think that that kind of censorship isn't happening here.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a dilemma that faces companies like Facebook and other companies in the West. Russia has announced that companies that leave Russia because they want to boycott it, or they want to hurt it, or they don't want anything to do with Russia. So think of Coca-Cola bottling companies. Think of software manufacturers. Think of just about anything that the United States makes, including, let's talk about all those, what is it, roughly 900 McDonald's across Russia, not to mention KFC and Pizza Hut and all the other stuff that we've got going on over there. Russia came out with a statement yesterday saying, check it out, guys. If you leave Russia, we are going to seize your assets. So all those McDonald's stores, those are ours now. Are you loving that? So that's a threat. Now, I don't know to what extent that would really mean anything one way or the other. The Kremlin said, if foreign owners close the company unreasonably, then in such cases, the government proposes to introduce external administration. Depending on the decision of the owner, it will determine the future fate of the enterprise. The key task will be to preserve the activities of organizations and jobs. Most businesses are announcing a temporary suspension while maintaining jobs and wages, and we will be closely monitoring this situation. And as you read the article, you see that what it's saying here is that, okay, if you keep paying our people and this is only temporary and you plan to come back, okay, that we can live with that. But McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Apple, British Petroleum, Shell, Goldman Sachs, all the other ones, not to mention Kentucky Fried Chicken, etc. If you like stop paying the people because you're closing your stores, because you're protesting Russia, and for all intents and purposes, you kind of pull out, then we're taking over. And they can do that. I'm not saying they should do that. But this, of course, will complicate matters for those business owners and their shareholders in determining how exactly to handle this situation. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Gorbachev did a, what was it? Was it a Pizza Hut commercial back in the day? Or Wendy's or something like that?
Oh, that's right. I had
Mikhail Gorbachev.
I had totally forgotten about that. I want to look for that on YouTube.
The former leader of the Soviet Union reduced to doing fast food commercials for an American company. I mean, talk about turnabout, right? 888-914-9149. Let's go to, how about Ann in Dover, Delaware? Hi, Ann.
Hi, Patrick. I enjoy your show, and I appreciate that you you think about things, and you're smart.
Well, thank you.
But my question is about this whole global warming nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And are you familiar with a writer named Michael Brown? He wrote a book called Sent Earth back in the 90s.
I'm afraid I'm not. Pope,
okay, well, he convinced Pope St. John Paul II to let him go into the Vatican archives.
Oh, that Michael Brown. Okay, then I guess I am somewhat familiar with him.
So he could.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt you. We have an issue with Ann's phone? I thought we did. So, Cyrus.
Yeah, she should be. She should. Well, Ann,
you know how we have.
Okay.
Patrick. Can you hear me?
Now I can, yes. For a moment, I couldn't hear you, but please go ahead, Ann.
Okay, so you know how we have summer, winter, spring, and fall, 3 months for each cycle. That's a cycle. Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Brown says that there's a bigger cycle, a 500-year cycle. Remember, he went back before Galileo even. And everybody knows that the Vatican is the only one that has all those records. And he tracked the weather records, and he said there's a 500-year cycle. And it's the warming cycle, which we're at the end of the warming cycle now, the hot cycle, the cooling cycle, the cold cycle, which was the ice age. So this is just a way to tax people. They can't change these 500-year cycles any more than they can change the four seasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first thing I would propose is that this is nothing unique to him. This is not something he discovered. This is not... I mean, this meteorological phenomenon has been known for a very long time, and it's I would say widely known, even if we just consider the epochs, ice ages and the warming periods and things. So I grant fully the scientific evidence that supports the fact that we go through these cycles. And you're right that there is a political dimension to this that seeks to redistribute wealth through things like a carbon tax, carbon footprint tax, and things. The whole thing has become very politicized. And one of the things, it seems to me, Anne, that makes this situation more intractable is you've got people who, when they hear that message about climate change, it used to be global warming, then it became climate change. They saw the movie by former Vice President Al Gore, An Inconvenient Truth. She hung up, I think, didn't she, Cyrus?
Yes.
Okay, well, maybe she was having phone issues. Perhaps that was the problem. There is a kind of a built-in suspicion on the part of some people that if it's coming from Al Gore, then it's got to be wrong. It's just because it's got to be political. And I would agree with that to some extent, especially with regard to him. If there had been somebody less political, more neutral, more, I don't know, thoughtful and not mercenary the way Al Gore always seemed to be, then maybe that message might have found a fairer hearing on the part of people who might be predisposed to ignore it simply because it's coming from a political source like that. So I don't know where we were going to go with that call because she hung up, but you're welcome to call back anytime. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Marie in Minneapolis. Good morning, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
Good. So I was calling. My main question is regarding the Old Testament law. So
okay.
Basically, I grew up Catholic, and I'm kind of at an age now where I really want to kind of make my faith my own and understand why we do what we do. And so I've been kind of diving into, I know that like some Christians, they do follow still the Old Testament law. Mm-hmm. So I've been diving into it, and I would have to say it's quite overwhelming trying to figure it all out. So I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
My main focus is basically like the salvation issue regarding it. So like Galatians 3:15 through 20, it explains how our salvation does not come from the law. Mm-hmm. But in Matthew 5:17 through 20, it talks about how it's said that people won't enter the kingdom of heaven unless they follow the law. And right. It states that like not one stroke of the law will be abolished until heaven and earth pass away. Mm-hmm. And like in the footnotes of my Bible, it tells me that the heaven and earth passing away is referring to Isaiah's statement about the new heaven and new earth in Isaiah 65.
Mm-hmm.
But so then when I go to Isaiah 65 to read about that, it seems like when how he describes the new heaven and the new earth, I mean, I would say it's not what our earth looks like today. So that makes me feel like, okay, then we should be following every quote unquote stroke of the law. But then, you know, when we pay attention to how Jesus was, he didn't follow all the laws. So, mm-hmm. you know, so it's
I think
very back and forth for me.
Right. I think I can help. So remember, too, this is a very good question, Marie. Remember, too, that Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 17, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Seems to me that is the key to understanding, in part at least, what you're referring to. Because in the very next sentence, he says, for truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of the pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So, all of that being the case, what is he referring to here? Two things to remember. Number one is that there are two different laws that are spoken of. And one of those is known as the Mosaic Law, and that's the ceremonial law that was enacted by God with Moses. And that includes 613 different precepts or different laws, going all the way down to which kind of food can be on which plate with which other kind of food. And, you know, what are all the ceremonial laws regarding ritual uncleanliness and the sacrifice of animals and keeping holy days, and how many steps can you walk on the Sabbath day and still be not considering it work, etc. So that's one body of law. And then you also have the law as such, which is the moral law that the Lord revealed most definitively in Jesus, but prior to that point in through Moses with the Ten Commandments. So that law is not the same law as the 613 Mosaic Covenant laws. And sometimes when you're reading Scripture, it's referring to one, sometimes it's referring to the other. And so in this case, if we consider what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, he's speaking in a certain sense about both, but you'll notice in verse 17, he says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them, meaning that in Christ, all of those things that were in force up until the time of Christ and his death on the cross, those things were in force. He says them. You know, even the least of these laws is something that people must observe, but he fulfills all of them, and in his fulfillment, they are no longer required. So it's not to say that he abolished them in the sense to say, well, ignore those things. He was placing the proper recognition of the value of the law as imperfect and as insufficient as it was, and saying that now I am going to fulfill all of that. So if you are in me, if you are in the covenant that I have, this new covenant, then all those particular 613 laws and the kosher food requirements and circumcision and ritual impurity and sacrificing animals and all that other stuff, that's all now been fulfilled. Now we're in the new law, and that doesn't in any way abrogate or in any way detract from the moral law. So when you're reading through those passages, Marie, just remember that sometimes it's referring to the Decalogue, the moral law and the Ten Commandments, and sometimes it's referring to the Mosaic ceremonial laws. Do you see that distinction? Have you...
Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate the clarification. And it's like really the part that I struggle with is the heaven and earth passing away part. So it talks about like until all of this is accomplished, and it talks about heaven and earth passing away. So that part I struggle with, like I almost wish that there was a scripture talking about like when Jesus died on the cross, that then that did create like a new heaven or a heaven and earth like passing away. Because the Isaiah scripture gets me, you know what I mean? Because that's not what our heaven and earth looks like now.
Well, that's if I have the same one you're thinking of, it's Isaiah 65:17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come to mind. Is that the one you're thinking of?
So it talks about, I'm trying to find it here. I had it.
It's probably that passage, Isaiah 65.
Like it talks about kids being able to sit with,
the lion will lay
like
down
children
with the
being
lamb.
Able to sit.
So that is an eschatological passage. So it's referring to the way things will be when the new heavens and the new earth are revealed. Now that, of course, is something that's spoken about in the book of Revelation. And so we're told that at that point, when this all is fulfilled, Revelation 21, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and the sea was no more. So that, as I understand it, in paying heed to the fathers and doctors of the church who comment on it, my understanding is that this is a merger between the natural realm and the supernatural realm. Where right now we live in the natural realm, and we're in the supernatural realm as well, but we can't see it. We can't experience it. All we can, with our senses, apprehend is the natural world, physical things, etc. So I believe that this new heavens and the new earth means that those seemingly separate categories or seemingly separate realms of reality are going to be merged into one single realm, in the way that at the end of the world we receive our bodies back. So we will be in heaven enjoying the glories of heaven bodily as well as spiritually. And so that part right there, of course, will not happen until the end. And when the end happens, then all of these things, the old things, pass away. And St. Peter says that it's all going to be burned up in fire. Whatever that may mean, I don't know. But it will be replaced by the new heavens and the new earth. And then in that final stage, there will no longer be any law. We will have no need of law. There will be no law. The Ten Commandments will be superfluous. Doesn't mean that they won't be true in theory, but there will be no need to propound them, because nobody in heaven is going to be killing anybody or stealing or bearing false witness or coveting. All of it will have been fulfilled in Christ. You see?
Yeah.
It's beautiful when you think of it that way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Well, I'm glad we had a chance.
Well, thank you.
I have to take a break, I'm afraid. I've got to scoot for a minute anyway.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. As a certain Gomer Pyle would say. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Hey, there's a line open, so now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Tell me what you think about this. Newsweek has an article. I want to get your opinion. My number, by the way, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Headline. Nearly 40% of U.S. Gen Zs and 30% of young Christians identify as LGBTQ. This is according to a new poll. And I touched upon this topic briefly, I don't know, a couple of months ago, but it's kind of back in the news again. 30% of millennials identify as LGBTQ, according to the soon-to-be and by now release study that is based on scientific polling. Among Christians, the numbers were lower, but only slightly lower, with just under 30% of millennial Christians identifying as LGBTQ. It's nearly a third. One out of every three people in that age bracket who identify now as LGBTQ. For what it's worth, it may not be worth much, but when I was in high school, I think I was aware of one particular guy, and this was a high school of, you know, I don't know, 2,000 students or something like that. I think my graduating senior class was about 400 to 500 students. And I think I remember knowing about a guy who everybody knew was gay. And that's about it. And that doesn't mean that there weren't those who had same-sex attraction or were maybe even living a homosexual lifestyle, but it wasn't known. I mean, it wasn't something public, and to the extent that it was public in any given case, it wasn't something that people were like, yeah, that's great, let's celebrate it. So things have changed, it seems to me, if now nearly a third of the Gen Z people identify as LGBTQ.
They feel like they have to. Mm-hmm. They have to identify as that, Patrick, because if you identify as straight, then you're homophobic. And this is straight out of my seventh grader's mouth. This is what she's experiencing at her school.
So let me give it to me straight here. So how? And no pun intended. How would you summarize what she's told you? She comes back from class and says, "Dad, guess what? Here's what they told us in school."
Yeah, she's really frustrated, and she says, she told me that at her school there's two groups. There's straight people, and then there's
LGBTQ.
That's right. And the LGBTQ consider straight people to be homophobic. So it's not that you can't if you're straight, you're only straight because you hate gay people.
Oh, so in other words, they're telling the kids that if you don't take a walk on the wild side, then you are homophobic. That's why you won't take a walk on the wild
side.
That's
exactly right.
I see.
It's terrible.
Do, 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 do. I don't know if you know that song.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't play it.
But I mean, I don't even know what to do.
So what do you tell her?
I have used your advice. And I wish I could say it as eloquently as you do about, and I'm failing for words here. It's the bit you've done it a few times with acceptance and, I'm failing my
not
words.
Not being judgmental and right. Diversity.
That's it. It's the diversity and, right. And acceptance and we're all inclusive.
Tolerance.
Right.
Yeah.
But. That you don't tolerate.
Have you taught her how to turn it around so that she can say, "How come you're being intolerant to me? You're not into diversity because you won't accept my diverse view."
I'm trying to, okay. And you make it sound so easy when you do it. Because I'll listen to you on the show, and then I'll be like, "All right, I've got all my tools here. All right, I'm gonna go. You know, talk to the family, and then it just never comes out the way mm-hmm. you do it so well." And I wish I had that power of gab, but I don't.
Thank you. And you know, you in your own way as a dad, you're going to be able to do it in your own way. Everybody listening right now, they can do it in their own way. It's a matter really of just sort of discovering what to say, and then you put it in your own words. So I would encourage you, you know, just keep going, keep doing that, and little by little, hopefully that will help with her being in the classroom when she's being bullied or looked down upon or marginalized because she's not LGBTQ plus, and they're always adding extra digits and letters after that. Well, back to this, and thank you for that, Cyrus. Back to the article, just to share a little bit more. It used to be, based upon the deeply flawed Kinsey study of sexuality that for the longest time held sway over the minds of many people in this country, and his claim was that 10% of the population, generally speaking, of all ages, is homosexual in this country. And that was sort of the operating thesis for a long time. Now, if you dig a little deeper, you'll find out that Alfred Kinsey was a terribly deviant, sexually deviant and corrupt. And I don't want to add too many descriptors to him, but he was just not only a paragon of virtue, but also he badly manipulated the statistics. So, for example, the survey sampling of his the people that he questioned about their sexual activities, a hugely disproportionate number of these people were men in prison. And if you know a little bit about that, and I don't from personal experience, but it doesn't take much Googling to find out more. But I mean, that would be an area where you would have a grossly disproportionately high number of people engaging in that activity just because of the circumstances. So it skewed the numbers, long story short. So this new poll that was undertaken by George Barna, he's a Protestant, and he's got a polling company, the Barna Institute. It's kind of like Pew Research or Quinnipiac, these different groups that have the polls. And so he did a poll looking at these different age groups, and that's what he came up with. He says, by and large now, nearly a third of Christian Gen Z people are saying that they identify as LGBTQ. Now, those in the general population who are not self-professed Christians, that number goes higher to about 40%, which I suppose if time continues, it may rise higher than that. Can you imagine, Cyrus, in a society where, let's say, half of the people, 50%, maybe more, identify as LGBTQ, and maybe not because they actually are, but because they feel they have to, like your daughter is saying. The results differed from a Gallup poll that showed that 5.6% of U.S. adults of all ages are not heterosexual or straight. That's how they identify, as something other than heterosexual or straight. His poll was based on a sampling of 600 respondents representing millennials, and it was scientific. It was weighted properly for factors such as geographic location, race, and gender. It took 17 minutes to answer the 71 questions. The poll didn't ask directly whether the respondent was gay or straight, but instead asked to choose an answer to the question, thinking about your commitments, would you describe yourself as? And then it gave six different responses. So, you know, are you straight? Are you gay? Are you all the different permutations of that. So the point being is, and this is why I want to bring it to your attention, is that this is increasing significantly. And as you listen to this program for any length of time, you will invariably hear parents or aunts or uncles or grandparents or concerned figures calling in to say, my 13-year-old daughter says that she thinks she's bisexual, or my 13-year-old daughter thinks that she's actually a boy. What do I do? So this is a phenomenon that's expanding very rapidly. Now, I don't think that in many cases that this is an actual reality. I don't think that these people are, by and large, actually fitting into these categories. But I think that, as you said, Cyrus, there's a lot of pressure to conform. And that pressure to conform leads to all sorts of compromises that these young people would feel they have to make in order to not be bullied or to be outcasts. So this is a fascinating article. If you're interested, especially if you have a school-aged child, it's well worth your time to review these statistics and take that into account when you're talking over the dinner table with your son or daughter or sons and daughters about what they're learning in school. 888-914-9149. Let's go to John in Wheaton, Illinois. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Patrick. You know, I was calling about this reference yesterday. There was a college student that referred to a human fetus as a parasite. And, you know, I was just horrified to hear that reference. And I don't think that there's a clear understanding of the definition of parasite. You know, a parasitic is an organism that lives in or on an organism of another species. In other words, its host. And it derives nutrients at the expense of that host. And that clearly does not define a human fetus. I would say that, you know, the human fetus is a symbiotic relationship. You know, it's right. Cooperative, mm-hmm. interdependent, you know, loving and nurturing. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to reach out before the end of the week here so that, you know, I hope that kid is out there listening. You know, it's understandable why today we have this insidious pursuit of abortion. If people are referring to human fetuses as a parasite, I mean, a parasite is something that should be removed. It does not belong.
I'm with you, John. I follow your logic, and I don't disagree with it. But let me expand it just a little bit further. There can be, in a strict sense, there can be a parasitic relationship. And don't get me wrong. I'm with you on this issue. The unborn baby is not a parasite. in the way in which the gentleman who called the other day was suggesting it. And I'm sure he's getting that because that's what he's hearing in the med school that he's attending. So don't misunderstand what I'm about to say, because I agree with your point. But if we expand it, we could say that the 25-year-old who just won't grow up and move out of the house, and he's living in his parents' house, and he's eating their food, and he's availing himself of their largesse, but he won't work, and he's just consuming, and he's not contributing, that's a parasitic relationship, and he's the same species as they are. So in a strict sense, in terms of like different species, what you're saying is absolutely correct. But I think in a broader sense, many people think of a parasite as something that doesn't necessarily have to be a different species, but just somebody who's leeching off somebody else or mooching off somebody else and doesn't give anything back. But as you say, that's not the nature of the mother-unborn child symbiotic relationship. It's not at all the same thing. So I, too, object to the use of the word parasite, but that was a conversation that was fast-moving, and we were dealing with a lot of different topics. So I didn't, in the moment, judge it worthwhile to stop there and haggle about that topic. If you wondered why I didn't, you know, pick up on that thread and say something, it was really for that reason. There was so much going on that I wanted to make sure that he and I had a chance to talk about kind of the bigger picture issues.
No, I understand, and I appreciate everything you do. I've been listening to you for several years now, and I'll be honest, without your radio program and relevant radio in general, I think many of us, would be lost.
Thank you.
But I just wanted to say that the best example I can think of a parasitic situation, I would refer to everybody to the 1979 science fiction movie with Sigourney Weaver, Alien.
Yeah.
I don't need to go and to describe it, but that is a parasitic relationship.
That is so true. Hey, let's push that a little further, John. I don't know if you saw Aliens. That was the second
one. Game over, man. Game over.
That's right. did you notice the anti-life, anti-pregnancy theme in the third Aliens, where she is... Okay, first of all, let's go back to the first one, Alien. The appearance in the mess room, the galley on the Nostromo, where the first alien makes his sudden appearance at dinner time. Remember that scene? That was the scene, the gross out scene that everybody remembered. You know what I'm
talking
about?
I do. And by the way, I do, because by the way, the actors involved in that scene were not told of that unfolding.
So they could be genuinely shocked when they saw what happened.
Yes. Yeah. So if anybody looks at that, take a look at their faces and you can see. So.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're clearly up on these details. So I just want to share with you my perspective. That was a not so subtle way to make horrifying the act of giving birth to a baby, which obviously didn't happen in exactly the same way. But that theme reoccurs throughout this, to the point where in the third one, Sigourney Weaver is basically impregnated by the alien. And there's a scene where the alien leans in really, really close to her. I mean, he would otherwise kill her, but he leans in really, really close to her, sort of like smiling at her, and she's cringing. And the reason is because he doesn't want to hurt her, because he's now carrying the alien baby. And spoiler alert, what she does to stop this whole thing is she jumps into a cauldron of what's, I guess, like lava or acid or something, to kill herself and to kill the thing within her. All of it, I took it to be a sort of a paean to abortion. And this idea that if you are carrying a baby that you don't want, that's a parasite, and the best thing to do is to kill it. That seemed to be a running theme through those Alien movies. Now, I don't know, John, if you had the same reaction to those scenes that I did, but that was my takeaway.
Well, no, I can't say I did. It was more the entertainment factor, but I understand. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it, Patrick.
You got it, John. Thank you. I appreciate your thoughtful comments. I'm lost, Cyrus. Yeah, that's right. We're way overdue for a break, aren't we?
You knowing so much about science fiction movies almost makes me want to cry with happiness. I'm so proud of you.
Oh. All right, I'll be right back, and I'll do you proud on the other side of this quick timeout. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
I love my job, that's for sure. I love spending time with you. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to John in Orlando. Good morning, John.
Hey, Patrick. I had the honor of meeting you at the JMJ Life Center banquet here in Orlando last year. I'm a family physician, and I have to tell you this LGBTQ information that you share with everybody, I've always found it interesting. You know, of course, people understand lesbian, gay, trans, and bisexual. That Q is really pivotal to understand what they mean by the Q. I don't see people referring to themselves as queer hardly ever anymore, but the Q, I think, mostly indicates questioning. And it really depends on what audience they're doing these surveys and what group of people, because a lot of younger people are questioning. Unfortunately, they're questioning, but thanks to good influences like, you know, the church and you, others, we have hope. There's hope if they're questioning. And there's hope if they've even identified themselves as the other four things. But really, we need to know what are they getting at with these surveys. Mm-hmm. How many are actually questioning versus they're already solidly identified as one of the other four?
Yeah, this was a lengthy survey. I think it ran to over 70 questions, and it was scientifically conducted so as to make it more meaningful. And we have a link to it posted if you're interested in reading it. And that way you can maybe take some of your medical expertise and apply it to the findings there. But it's fascinating. Now, in my experience, John, the Q in LGBTQ is queer insofar as that's a very common term that's used, gender queer, for example, as in not gender conforming. Now, I would agree with you that there's probably a great deal of questioning that goes on. All you have to do to see it for yourself is to fire up TikTok and look at the libs of TikTok, and you'll see it constantly, these people saying, well, you know, today I feel like this kind of a gender, and tomorrow I feel like that kind of a gender, and it's all very fluid. And you know, that strikes me as somebody who really, without realizing it, is questioning, well, who am I and what am I and why, you know, why do I feel the way I do? So if your point is that we need to tap into that question and try to direct them toward the truth, then I'm 100% with you. You know, there is an answer to that question.
Yeah.
And it's found in the truth of Jesus. And we have to help people.
Well, and then just real quick, because I might lose you, I'm going through Mount Dora. The medical schools and all of the medical profession right now, I mean, my journals are loaded with articles saying how to make your waiting room more gender-friendly, trans-friendly, LGBTQ. And so if you're a medical student and you have, as you all know, with pro-life or any other issue of the day, and you're trying to be anything other than PC, to say the least, with these issues, you're going to be persecuted. I've seen it firsthand with residents and medical students.
I believe it. Yeah.
It's so sad. So pray for all the future doctors and, of course, even the present doctors. It's a hard road to hoe right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Stay safe as you drive along the highway, and I appreciate the call. Thank you. Let's go to Araceli now in Chicago. Hello, Araceli.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. I'm so excited. I've been listening to your show for about a year, and I just want to say thank you for everything that you have shared. I am taking it all in. But I wanted to comment on something that happened to my child. She's in fifth grade, in regards to, like, you know, kids choosing. asexuality or whatever it is. My child was wearing a shirt with a rainbow heart, and she was being bullied. You know, they were calling her that she was, that she liked females, by her own peers, like own friends, which I told her, those are not your friends. But I was just in shock to think that in fifth grade, even, you know, children are pushing other children to think in one way or the other, to think that they are, you know?
Yeah, this is a very common thing, what you're describing. Sadly, Araceli, I'm so sorry to hear that it's happening with your own daughter, but it goes way below the fifth grade. This is being pushed in pre-kindergarten. This is being pushed on little kids,
right.
3, 4 years old and up, and it's become a real tsunami. So what are you doing? What strategies have you employed to help your daughter navigate through this problem?
Well, I've always just tell her that, you know, God created us as male and female, and that is, you know, that our purpose as men and women is to, you know, either get married and procreate, and that's the only way we can, by, you know, being a female and a male in marriage. I've always been very, well, I try, you know, especially after listening to your show, and telling them that this is really what we were created as, female or male. There's no other.
How does your daughter react when you teach her these things?
You know, sometimes I think that they'll just open their eyes a little bit wide. I have a 14-year-old who kind of speaks her mind on it a little bit more, but she's coming to understand. I went through the same situation with her. But she's come to understand that this is what God intended for us. It's only male and female. And people will make their choices, because it's really choices that they're doing.
Yep. Oh.
They're not right. Mm-hmm. I've always just told them, you know, we love them as the human beings that they are. But that doesn't make their decision right.
That's right. You have to. I've got to press on. You've got to. It's good that you're doing that, and I encourage you to keep doing that. Let your children know that they have a role to play in speaking the truth in love. Be loving, be respectful, don't be rude or mean, but don't be afraid to speak the truth, especially when people all around you need to hear it as much as they do now, that's for sure. Thank you. Let's go to Adriana now in Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick. I am calling because I have a little dilemma. I donate to different religious organizations, obviously Catholic, and then they send you really nice gifts, you know, little knickknacks,
right?
Address labels.
I know what you mean. We have about 90 seconds.
And I don't know what you do with them. I don't want to be rude and throw them out, but I can't keep accumulating them.
Yeah. So here's what you can do. Are you wondering what to do with these things?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So what you can do is you can burn them. So maybe set up a little fire in your barbecue, or if you have like a fire pit or something like that, you can burn them. That's an appropriate way to handle that. If it's something more durable, that is, you know, if it's something that would be of use to like a local school or parish, you can donate them. If it's a holy card, an image of Jesus or something like that, you can donate those. Many parishes or schools would be happy to receive those for the sake of the children. But if you can't do any of those things, you can, you know, let's say that there are pictures of Jesus and Mary that you don't want to go into the trash can or anything like that. You could put them through the shredder. Then they just become confetti, and there would be no danger of them being disrespected. If you wanted to burn them, the church says that's a very appropriate way to do that. So that way you're not allowing things that are holy or represent holy things to have a, you know, kind of a disrespectful disposition. Burying, burning, donating, if ever you can do that, that'd probably be my first choice. I wish I had more time, Adriana, but I hope that helps you. Thank you. Well, I'm looking forward to being with you again real soon, and I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
I want you to know it's over.